evening. I hope everybody's well.
Yes. Thank you.
Please join me in saying the Anabakoa. Anabakoa. Yadula Chimita. Of their own. and be moved no more. Neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them any more, as at the first. And the eighth verse we say in a whisper. Reading a verse from the Zohar. I'm reading from the prologue to the Zohar. Section 21, the precepts of the Torah. The third precept, verse 204. Tiku datalita lamin dadit elaha ravravada shalita the alma uyachada le bekoyama yehuda kita yaot beinun chit citrin ilain umebad lon yehuda chada Ushitevin Dishma Yisrael Ufavna Deutaleela Echadaehu Vialza Echad Itzterich Learka Lebeshit Hivitevin. The third precept is one. To know that there is an Almighty Hashem who governs the world. Two, to proclaim His unity properly every day using the supernal 6 points. Chesed Gevurah Tiferet Netzach Choden Yesodah Zeranpin. Three, to unify them, the 6 points, into one whole by the 6 Hebrew words of Shema Yisrael. And four, to orient our desire with them spiritually. Therefore, we should prolong the pronunciation of the word Echad to the length of time it takes to pronounce the other sacred 6 words. You've now, I think this is the first time I've read in a class. I've read it in Zohar classes, but I think this is the first time I've read a spiritual law as described in the Zohar. The halakha is that you are to lengthen the saying of the last word when you say the Shema. You're supposed to lengthen it out. Echad. You do the first syllable quickly and extend out Echad. And this Zohar is telling us to do that for the same amount of time it takes to pronounce the 6 words, or literally the other 5 words. That's the halakha from the Shulchan Aruch. In the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't tell us how long. It just says lengthen it out. Elsewhere in the Zohar, it says doing so, it brings a riddle, and I forget the exact form of the riddle. But the answer to the riddle is someone who says the Shema and lengthens out Echad, he receives some really true beneficence in this physical world, as well as the full effect in the world that is coming. This preface in this particular section has 14 precepts. And one would think that these are the important precepts. But why not 15 precepts? 15 is Yud-Kei. It's the upper worlds. And we're trying to connect to the upper worlds because that's the world that is coming. But there's 14, and 14 relates to Malchut, to the physical world. And it's a question I've asked ever since I read this fully, which was about 10 years ago. And I've had some answers to that question of why not 15, because we have 613 mitzvot. But one of the answers I received, but it wasn't something I read. It was just something that occurred to me as an answer to that question, is that these 14 mitzvot are the permanent mitzvot. They apply in every reincarnation. Whereas other mitzvot, you have to do in one of your incarnations. As an example, we need to be the high priest. Well, you know, if you're not the high priest, how can you be a high priest? But from a mitzvah standpoint, from a completion of our tikkun, we need to be a high priest to be able to do the mitzvot associated with the high priest. But we also do that every time we read the liturgy on Yom Kippur. So these 14 mitzvot really are very significant, and they apply to every reincarnation, where others apply only to not necessarily every incarnation. Because each Gilgul, there is something for you to learn, there's something for you to do as part of your tikkun. But just because you've achieved a tikkun for this lifetime doesn't mean that you've achieved the tikkun for the next lifetime. There's something else, because each lifetime is part of the process to go from the thought of creation to the Mashiach in creation. Does anybody have any questions? Tonight's class is class number 26. And if you go to the Revealed Wisdom section, row 11, the second column from the left, you'll see the Advanced Reincarnation Series. When you click on that link, it opens up to the page, and if you scroll down to class 26, you'll find the handout for tonight's class, which is the same handout as last week, but it will open up to the appropriate point where we are going to start. And as I said last week, hopefully I would be able to bring a quick summary to give you some perspective. And so that's what I'm going to try to do now. But hopefully you guys read what we went over during your homework this week. Chapter 8, which we read 2 weeks ago. That we read last week. Chapter 8 is giving us different reasons for reincarnation. It's not an exhaustive list. It's just a few reasons. Chapter 9, we don't know what it's going to teach us. But the section that we're reading now is an introduction to Chapter 9. For some reason, the Arif and Chaim Vital felt that they needed to prepare us for whatever is going to come in Chapter 9. And the way they do this is with this concept of the flying tower. And the flying tower is metaphorical. It has many different meanings. It could be the male organ. It could be something totally different. It could be many different concepts. Because just as there are 70 key levels of Torah, there's 70 levels of the flying tower. And these two men, Doeg and Akitofo are incarnating, because this whole discussion is about incarnation, and it's about their relationship to King David. And these two men bring this idea that King David's line is spiritually defiled, and therefore he shouldn't be king, and therefore there shouldn't be a Mashiach. A Mashiach coming through King David. And we stopped at this point where who were Doeg and Achitophel? But essentially, this whole section we're reading right now is trying to prepare us for what is coming in chapter 9. And I hope that's gave you a structure to understand what all this is about with these 400 questions. Essentially, the questions that are being asked are logically correct questions. They're in the Torah, a perfect example is in the Torah, we have a verse that says in Exodus chapter 20, it says in the Esther Dibrot that God will take the sins of a man and put it on his children up to 3 or 4 generations. And then in Deuteronomy, it says that no man suffers from the mistakes of another, from the sins of another. And the words are the same, because in Hebrew you have different words for sin. So the words have to be the same. They are the same. So how do you reconcile these two statements? Logically, it appears there's something fallible in the Torah. God forbid. Doeg and Achitophel were using this type of logic, these types of questions, to impugn King David, to impugn the Torah, to impugn the plan of creation. And that is where, during King David's life, no one could answer them. It took an injection of wisdom to King Solomon, who requested that injection of wisdom, not for the purpose of answering Doeg and Achitophel. But he was injected with this wisdom, and with that wisdom he was able to reconcile all of these things, including a logical answer, a simple answer, a drash, an allegorical answer, and the sod answers. Those were the levels that he answered each of those 400 questions. And that is some of the 3,000 parables, not parables, but 3,000 proverbs that are not in the Torah. But they are in the Talmud, in the teachings in the Talmud. Throughout the teachings of various sages over the centuries, all of this information has been brought forward. But every generation was different. Every generation has a different correction. So the questions would arise on the level of the soul to those generations where it was important that they know it, that they be able to answer it. But in other generations, their correction was on the simple level. So all they studied in those generations was the halakha of tort. How do you pay back something that is stolen? What do you do if your animal harms a human being? All of these kinds of issues, which for most of us is not important, meaningless, totally ridiculous, and yet There are people in generations, and there are people in every generation that need to study it at that level. This is all relating to reincarnation. But in what's being taught here, what's being brought here, it doesn't make that clear. So I hope this is helpful for you as we go forward. Are there any questions before I start? Who are Doeg and Ahitofo? Doeg, in addition to being, this is getting priceless. I apologize. I got to figure out a way to change the settings on my laptop so it doesn't go dark when I need it. Doeg, in addition to being the head of the Sanhedrin at the ancient court and the legislature of Israel. Now, that's interesting to me because Israel has a government in Trinity, in a triple. People don't realize that. But Torah law says there are three parts to the government. One part is the executive branch, my term, the Torah doesn't call it that. And that was Moshe. One part is the priestly branch, which is an advisor to the executive branch, and a connection channel to help people and the executive branch answer questions and know what God's plan is. The priest has a better connection to the Creator than the executive does. But the executive has his own connection to the Creator. And together, they work together, they enhance each other together. This is all part of the plan of creation, all part of the system. And that's two of the branches. And the third branch, which is being said here, is that it's the judicial branch, which is true, the Sanhedrin is the courts. But he's also saying it's the legislature, that they pass the laws. But actually, the executives reveal the laws that Hashem gave in the reality. So what is the purpose of the court? To interpret the interpretations of the executives' drawing of the spiritual laws into our world and presenting it to us. It's the same type of government that the United States follows, but it's applied differently, and their roles are different. But they balance each other. They work together. And this is the government prescribed by Torah law. This is the government that the state of Israel will move towards, so that when Mashiach manifests, the structure of the Sanhedrin will be in place. The structure of a high priest will be in place. And the Mashiach will be able to become the executive and bring serenity to all of the nations. I guess I got a little bit sidetracked. I'm sorry. So Doeg is the head of the Sanhedrin. He also commands the special police of King Saul. In that capacity, he pursued David relentlessly. And of all the advisors of King Saul, he was the most insistent that David had to be eliminated. So was he insistent that David had to be eliminated because he was zealous in doing his job? Or was he doing so because of a tikkun relationship with the soul of King David? So far, we don't know. When David appeared out of obscurity to kill Goliath, King Saul began to inquire after his identity and the lineage of his family. Doeg answered, before you inquire about the lineage of his family, inquire whether they are even allowed to be members of the congregation, since one of the matriarchs of the family is Ruth the Moabitess. Women, according to Doeg, who is an Edomite, her ancestors are not even allowed to be part of the Jewish people. In this way, he wanted to banish David from any position of leadership, despite the fact that permission for a Moabite woman, as opposed to a man, to enter the congregation had already been decided by several courts, several Sanhedrins, prior to the time that we're talking about. Achitophel was the wisest of all counselors in the generation of King David. Had Absalom, King David's son, followed the advice of Achitophel when he rebelled against his father, then David's cause would have been lost and the king would have been killed. Indeed, it may be that the entire rebellion was the design of Achitophel, and Absalom was just a helpless dupe against a force like that. I'm sorry to keep making these comments. When it's the writings of the Ari, or Chaim Vital, it's in bold. When it's commentary by the translator, or by, I forget his name right now, but it'll come to me. When it's commentary, it's not, there's no bold. So right now I'm reading the commentary. King David needed to be born. We have a midrash that says he was going to be stillborn. But Adam gave 70 years of his life. And in another midrash, it was given by Abraham and Jacob and Joseph to make up the 70 years of his life. And now we have a commentator who comes and brings another midrash that says Achitophel could have changed history, could have changed the plan of creation. And that is really an amazing statement for us to contemplate. Can we change the plan of creation? Can we affect Hashem so that the plan gets changed? We think we have free will and free choice. But as we've learned in the classes, we don't have free will and free choice, except whether to do binding by striking or not. But if we do binding or striking, we do change the current of time, and we could have changed what was written in the Torah. We could have said that Absalom, as the son of King David, became the king. And that could have happened. It's one of the timelines. It is not insignificant that King David is the prototype of Mashiach. And these two, Doeg and Achitophel, with their great minds and keen perceptions, were the most implacable and most dangerous of his enemies. Typical of secret agents working behind the lines with these questions, they wanted to confound and confuse, hoping in that way to cast doubts upon the legitimacy of the Davidic dynasty. Furthermore, they wanted to uncover a secret weakness in the root of King David's soul, a defilement or impurity in his reincarnation, or in the Gilgulim of his antecedents. In this way, they hoped to gain the power to stop the redemption. floating in the air with nothing to rest upon. There is another possible interpretation to the 400 questions of Doeg and Akitofel on the tower floating in the air. In the Mishnah of Nidarim, it makes the following statement. The annulment of vows are floating in the air, and they do not have anything to anchor upon. In other words, the body of law concerning the authority of the court to annul vows does not have any scriptural source to rest upon, and it is not anchored in any scriptural source. Although it has become established law, it floats in the air. King Solomon, the wisest of all men, answered all of the 400 questions. The decision to allow a Moabite woman to convert and enter the congregation may be comparable. The scriptural source for this ruling is questionable. It was established on the authority of the oral Torah. The courts of Boaz and Samuel, the prophet, ruled accordingly, and it was finally established once again by the Sanhedrin in the time of King David. Doeg and Akitofel asked 400 questions in an attempt to nullify this ruling. Although their logic was impeccable and could not be disproved until the time of Solomon, King David's son, the courts consistently ruled against them because there was a tradition that took precedent over their logic. That, too, is a tower floating in the air. My commentary. What is this all about? Why is it important? Let us put it in perspective. Doeg and Akitofel hate King David. So what? This is a battle between the two kings, Satan and Hashem. The stool of Satan is logic. I know most of you don't like to hear that, so I will repeat it. The tool of Satan is logic. The tool of Hashem is both logic and tradition intuition. Which should one follow? In the Western world, with Western education, logic is the tool that we follow. If one cannot prove something logically, if one cannot measure something physically, then it is not important and of no consequence. The majority rules. This means that a minority of one is meaningless in this Western world. This is not the halakha. This is not the teachings of Torah. This subject is too long to answer at this point. But in brief, Torah teaches majority of knowledgeable people rule, not the majority of people. So a minority of one who is knowledgeable in the subject, who is connected to his intuition, prevails over the majority. Why were these 400 questions not answered until King Solomon? It is to teach us the meaning of hatred in the frame of reincarnation. A spark of a soul is captured by another soul. Doeg and Akitofel accuse King David of having something negative within his Gilgul. This is their mirror. This is the spark of their soul captured by King David. This is the cause of the hatred. And the study of this approach is how to handle removing hatred from the world. The identification of the tower floating in the air has many metaphors, from an erect penis to the essence of purity, to the essence of malchut, which is purity surrounded by impurity, light surrounded by the shells of the klipot. There is much more to comment about the floating tower, yet it requires a vessel to reveal the light, and that takes questions. And I may not be able to answer these questions because I am not a wise man. Does anybody have any questions? We're now going to read from the more commentary, but eventually we will get to the point where the Saba enters the place of the 400 questions. In the Parasha of Mishpatim, which is where most of our laws of reincarnation come from, there's other sources as well earlier than the Zohar. There's other sources after the Zohar. There's writings from various Kabbalists. But the majority of our information comes from the Zohar and the Sefer that we're reading, which is the Sharei Gilgulim. As mentioned previously, the number of difficulties and questions raised by Doeg and Akitovo, according to the Zohar, is not 3, but 400. The Holy Zohar also says that King David's son, King Solomon, the wisest of all men, answered all of them. Furthermore, in the Zohar, the Saba of Mishpatim also asks, by the way, Saba means grandfather, also asks and answers some of them, or at least one of them in the middle of this section. It is stated explicitly that the Saba has entered into the palace of the 400 questions. Some of the text that records it will follow. Indeed, it may be that the entire text of the Saba in Zohar, Mishpatim, from its beginning to the all of it, is in the palace of the 400 questions. There is a writing on this website called The Riddle of the Saba. And I put this link. I said I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I actually did paste it into the bottom of this, what we're reading today. However, we can translate and explain the explicit text. We must first recall something that was learned previously. There is a phenomenon called the spirit that is left within the woman. Do you remember reading about that, speaking about that? When a woman has intercourse with a man, the first time, there is a deposit of his soul, part of his soul, a reshima, a shadow of his soul, is left in her womb. This split remains within her at all times. However, what happens when her first husband dies, she remarries, and the spirit of her second husband enters within her. This is one of the 400 questions. The halakha of the black widow, this is my commentary, of the black widow comes from this idea of the conflict in the womb between these reshimot of the first husband and the second husband, and also the potential of the third husband. I'll also just make a quick comment that I really don't want to spend any time on. But in our generation, with the concept of free love and the freedom that women were given, the fear of pregnancy being reduced by the estrogen pill, there is this spiritual discussion, this spiritual law, this description every man that a woman has been intimate with, there is a reshima within her womb. And if there is conflicts with between those reshimot, between those shadows, between the essences of these men, that conflict of the men can create chaos in the life of the woman. One of my teachers once said, and I never really addressed it or attacked it, but one of my teachers once said, that is the reason why it's not a good idea for women to be intimate with many, many men. Reading from the Saba of Mishpatim. Say your thing, Saba. The Holy King is here. Come and see how high are the awesome and mighty things the Holy King does. Who can speak about them? His spirit is flopping around within her womb like a snake, and it quarrels with the other spirit of the second husband that has entered. When the second husband comes and puts his spirit into this vessel, the first spirit quarrels with this spirit that has entered, and they cannot settle down together. For this reason, the woman does not settle down properly with her second husband. The first spirit knocks around within her. She always remembers him and cries and grieves for him because his spirit is flopping around within her womb like a snake. And it quarrels with the other spirit of the second husband that has entered. If this spirit that has entered pushes out the first one, then the first one goes its way. Sometimes the first one pushes out the second and quarrels with it until he takes it out from the world. And that is why we have learned that a man should not marry a woman who has had two husbands that have died on her, because the angel of death is strong within her. People do not realize that it is the spirit of the first husband that has conquered the other spirit of the second husband, and that is why nobody should get mixed up with her. If the spirit of the first husband is strong enough to conquer and push out the second spirit, and consequently the second husband dies as well, then it is not advisable for any third man to marry her. It is likely that what has happened to the second husband will happen to the third as well. Therefore, tradition suggests that a man should not marry a woman who has had two husbands die on her, unless special banishing meditations are performed. However, the second spirit that has entered overpowers and conquers the first one. Then the first spirit goes out from there and goes on its way. To where does it go and what happens to it? Oh, Saba, Saba, he says to himself, what have you done? You thought you would say a few words and get out of this, but now you have entered a place that no one else has entered since the day of Gog and Akatoko. Made these difficulties. They asked 400 questions concerning the tower floating in the air, but no one could answer any of them, until King Solomon came along and clarified each one of them exactly. Saba, Saba, will you reveal this supernal secret that was hidden? What have you done? Saba, Saba, you should have watched yourself in the first place. But now, Saba, is not the time to hide out. Get your courage back. Where does the spirit that leaves her go? He began to cry. The spirit that goes out from her on its way wanders through the world, and it is not known. It goes to the grave of that man, the first husband, from where it originated. And from there it wanders about the world. It appears to people in dreams, who see in their dreams an image like that man. Thus it wanders in the world and constantly visits that grave until the time when the souls, the spirits, visit the graves of body. The second spirit, the soul spirit, is the spirit of the soul of the person who has died in the case of the first husband. The time that when the spirits of the soul visit the graves of the bodies is, for example, on the day of the Yahrzeit, the yearly anniversary of the day when the person died. It is customary that descendants and students visit the graves of the departed on the Yahrzeit to pray there, because it is a time when their prayers can receive assistance and power from the spirits of the departed ones. At such a propitious time, the spirit that was left within the woman by the first husband and has gone out from there to wander in the world meets the spirit of the soul of the first husband from whence it has come. I should really make a comment here. I didn't write it out. But when you talk about reincarnation, groups of souls travel together. How else could corrections be made? If two souls have made a mistake with each other and they have a correction to balance the universe with, to make the correction, and one of them dies, the other one can't make that correction in that lifetime, can it? But the first one who dies now is going to be reborn, going to incarnate into a new body. Now the second man, who was still living, dies. Now he reincarnates, but it's been 20 years on Earth that have passed. It isn't necessarily 20 years that it took him to die, but when he's born again, he becomes a child. He's in a totally different generation, but close enough as a to that generation of the first person that the tikkun can be achieved. And guess what will happen? He will be a descendant of that first person who dies. He will be a descendant, and he will go to visit his grandfather, his great-grandfather. And that soul now moves in, that Reshima now moves into the new body and returns to the fullness of the soul. The spirit joins with its main spirit, which clothes itself within it. The wandering spirit joins the main spirit of the soul that has come down to the grave. The former, the wandering spirit, becomes an exterior addendum to the latter until the soul spirit returns to its place. This is how it gets back to where it's supposed to go, and then the next day, that soul then goes back to where it's now currently being incarnated. When it goes into its place, it divests itself of it, the wandering spirit. But there is a place for it among the palaces of paradise, or just outside of them. And there that spirit shelters, each one according to its ways. When the spirits visit this world, when those that have died are needed among the living, then they ensconce within these spirits. Another description of the idea of the nefesh of a ger. There are times of trouble when the living need the assistance of the spirits of the deceased. In other words, there are times of trouble when the living need the assistance of the spirits of the deceased. In such times, the spirits of the deceased are able to communicate with the world of the living through the interface of these minor spirits that had been sheltering among the palaces of paradise, or just outside of them. Accordingly, it would seem that there is a happy ending to this story. The spirit drawn from the first husband that was left within the woman, which was banished as a consequence of her second marriage and made to wander through the world, has become the interface enabling communication between the spirits of the souls with the world of the living. However, the Saba rejects this contention. Perhaps you will say that it has been an advantage to the spirit, and this woman has benefited everyone. It is not so. If she did not marry another one, and if the first spirit had not been pushed out from before the other, then it would have had a different advantage, and it would not have had to wander in the world as it did. And it was not necessary for the living of this world that it should wander as it did here and there. Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yossi challenged the Saba's position on this issue with the following question. If that is the case, then the second union of this woman was not a good thing to happen. But you said that the rule is that one man is pushed out by another man. The Saba himself taught us this rule. It applies to these matters. One spirit is pushed out by the other. Therefore, it is quite natural that the first spirit should be pushed out from before the second. It is not a calamity, and it should not be looked at in a negative way. Now, one of them will ask him another stronger and more compelling question. And I say, maybe the second husband that married this woman is really her soulmate, and the first one was not her real soulmate. The second belongs to her, and when the time comes, the first one was pushed out from before him. Therefore, Saba pushing out the first spirit was not only natural, it was also just. The Saba answers, it is certainly true, it is certainly that way. The first spirit that was in this woman is never pushed out unless the second is her soulmate. And in all the cases where the second is pushed out from before the first ones, it is the first ones that are of the soulmates and not the others. That is why they cannot abide together. And the second spirit is pushed out from before the first one. Consequently, it is said about someone who marries a widow that he doesn't know his soul. He doesn't know what he is doing because the net is spread for no reason. He does not know if she is his soulmate or not. My commentary. We do have other tools to know if someone is a cosmic soulmate to a particular woman. Although this wisdom is never 100% certain, as the fifth sign of soulmates taught by the Arizal that we discussed a few times, that sign is never complete until the day of death of one of the partners. The Saba now introduces an entirely new possibility that coincides with his own preference in these matters. One husband, no more. There is a widow who does not remarry. Even if her soulmate comes along, but she does not want to remarry, God does not coerce her with force. He prepares another woman for the man, and he does not enter into harsh judgment with this one in this world, even if she never has any children, because a woman is not commanded to be fruitful and multiply, as it is known. Thus, even if her first husband who has died was not her soulmate, and the second potential husband is her soulmate, the Saba nevertheless prefers that the woman refrain from remarrying. Now we're going to the subject of Yibum. we can finish this before we get to the section that I added at the bottom, which we probably will not have time for today. And I'll leave that for you to read on your own and decide if you want to read the other sections that I didn't add here. There is one major instance where the Saba will agree that a woman should remarry after the death of her first husband. And the Torah just about obligates it as well. It is the case of Yibum, the Levirate marriage, where the first husband has died without leaving any progeny in the world. The brother of the deceased first husband, the woman's brother-in-law, is designated by the Torah to marry the widow. This act of Yibum will liberate the spirit that was left within her by the first intimate relationship with her first husband and build living progeny in the name of the deceased. Now, the foundations of the Davidic dynasty are the Yibum of Tamar by Judah, which brought out the twins, Peretz and I forget his other name. But basically, the reason Tamar had twins is that Judah was doing the rite of Yibum. He was marrying his daughter-in-law as he was the appropriate relative to bring the children, since he refused to give her his third son, because as far as he was concerned, she was a black widow, having killed two men. Not to say that she killed them, I'm just using the euphemism. Now, then in addition to Tamar and Judah with the Yibum, there's the Yibum of Ruth and Boaz. Because Ruth's husband died without children, and Boaz married her to perform Yibum. Both these relationships were questionable and susceptible to the challenges of Doeg and Achitophel. They are part of the tower floating in the air. Judah was not the brother-in-law of Tamar, but her father-in-law. Ruth was a Moabite woman, and her legitimate entry into the congregation was questionable, let alone that she should become the mother of the royal house. Furthermore, even if her marriage to Mahlon, the son of Elimelech, was legitimate, Boaz was not his brother, but his father's cousin. What kind of Yibum is that? The spirit that was left within the woman by her first husband may well have been flopping around within Tamar and Ruth, but did these unorthodox types of Yibum free those spirits and build them up? Could these relationships build the foundations of the genealogy of the kings of Israel and the Messiah? Around these issues, Doeg and Achitophel asked 400 questions, confounding questions, such as what happens to the spirit of the first husband? These are the 400 questions of Doeg and Achitophel from the tower floating in the air. So you can get a sense now of why it's the male organ is the tower floating in the air. The discussion of the points touched upon here goes on and on in the inevitable way of the Zohar and the Saba. Obviously, the Saba was quite reluctant to reveal these things. For us, it is not so much of a problem, since we do not understand too much of the Zohar anyway. But now the Holiyas Ari comes and tells us that he too will be revealing one of the 400 questions. Chapter 9 is one of the 400 questions that Doeg and Achitophel ask concerning the tower floating in the air. Like the Saba, the subject of Chapter 9 will be illicit sexual relationships, in particular that of homosexuality. How they affect Gilgulim, and how the sparks that fell into the Klipot because of the sin are ultimately redeemed. And I did add section 4 of the riddle of the Saba, so you can get an additional aspect of the Saba. And either I will read that next week, or you can do it as homework. And if enough of you do it as homework, then we'll just go on to the beginning of chapter 9 in class number 27. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes, I'd like to ask you something. Let's see. You mentioned earlier about the angel of death is strong within her. You said something about that she did some kind of a banishment, something.
Okay.
A ceremony or something. So I was trying to understand, for her to be set free of all these different men and all the chaos that transpires for her, that she can go through some kind of a banishment, something to set her free from all that, or is there protocol for that?
The first step in that protocol is any form of teshuvah. You have
okay.
to realize that it was a mistake, and you have to stop it. Then you go through the whole essence of teshuvah. Who was hurt in this process? Was you think it was only you? The woman who's hurt? Weren't the men hurt? Wasn't the society hurt? You have to evaluate who got hurt, just in any form of teshuvah. But yes, there are techniques, there are ways of banishing the reshimot that are in the uterus, in the womb, and to help remove the chaos. And ultimately, it starts with saying the Yana B'Koach every day. It starts with studying the Kabbalah. These things are protection shields. They calm the situation down. And if necessary, if for whatever reason they are strong and they keep coming back, then you need to do teshuvah on that whole level. Because you have to remember that women go to Gehinnom and get cleansed in that way.
Okay, do women that don't understand this process go through, turn to drugs maybe, and other, liquor, drinks, psychiatrists, anything? You think that's why they turn to those types of things, thinking that will eliminate their chaos, instead of they don't understand, what I'm saying?
They don't understand, and that's all part of the chaos, the fact that they don't understand. The fact that this knowledge is available to them because they don't want to study Kabbalah.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if they do study Kabbalah, I've had people say, I'll study with you for the basic class, but they don't want to go on anymore. And that's fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their own path.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, let's start with the understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Hashem micromanages the creation. Now, we think micromanaging is not a good thing to do. In business, it's not a good thing to do because you limit the creativity of the employees. But Hashem is not an employer. So his micromanaging is beneficial to everyone involved. But if you start with that understanding, you then come to an understanding that says, if he's micromanaging and I forgot something when I went out of the house this morning, and that the reason I forgot it is a correction, is part of the plan of creation. It's part of what Hashem is micromanaging. It's not just that I forgot something. There's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
That Hashem sent a klipa to my brain to keep me from getting that thought because he didn't want me to take that with me. He wants me to turn around and go back home. maybe to miss a traffic accident and be late to a meeting, or maybe for totally reasons. We don't really see everything, but we can have the certainty that Hashem is involved in micromanaging everything. And the more we look for a cause, the more chaos will be removed from our life. Because the human nature is not to look for cause. Human nature is to react based on what the body perceives through its five senses. Human nature is logical, the tool of Satan. Yes, a woman may not know that the values that came into the world in my generation, during the 60s and 70s, they may not have realized that these things were harmful to her. And it may not realize that the divorce that she went through was caused by this. May not understand cause and effect. Doesn't know to start to look for cause and effect. But that's part of the correction, too. It's part of the pain and suffering. And many times, pain and suffering is the fact that we don't understand the cause. And just because we don't understand the cause, that's the pain. I hope I have clarified but not confused you, because this is, it is very easy to take what I say and run down the road with it. But you need to stop and think, not logically, but intuitively, what I'm saying and how does it apply to a particular person? Not somebody other than yourself. How does it apply to yourself? Mm-hmm. And if you need to discuss it and you feel comfortable enough, I am available.
Okay. There was something I need to ask you also. You said that the woman was not commanded to multiply, as it's well known. So that commandment was given to just the man?
Yes.
Okay, and why was that?
I never heard an answer to that question. On one level, the woman diminished herself because she wouldn't accept shared royalty, sharing having two kings. So on the fourth day of creation, the woman, the female, went to God and said, how can you have two kings? How can you have the sun and the moon both having light? And God said, you're absolutely right, and please go diminish yourself. That is a midrash from the fourth day of creation. Now, bring that forward to the respect to the woman, to the female. Why should she procreate? God is saying, is giving her a commandment that she's going to have pain and suffering because she was cursed, chas v'shalom, God forbid. She was cursed to have pain in childbirth. She was cursed to have pain when she doesn't have a child. Her period. She was cursed for her part in the action of the mistake of Adam and Eve. They both participated. They both made the same mistake. Not the same mistake, but different aspects of the mistake. But you're saying to me, why didn't God command the woman to have children? Who wants children in this world? who has this deep inner need to bring children in this world? Does it come from men or does it come from women? And at the same time, if God commanded her to do this, he's saying, go do this mitzvah that you're going to have pain, not only just pain, but potential death, God forbid. You're going through a time of judgment, and you could die. How can that be a mitzvah? Is God going to put you, a loving kindness God going to put you in a frame of judgment? Is he going to put you in that place to risk your life? So he didn't give you an opening mitzvah, but he gave you this nature, this yearning to bring children. The man must choose it. He has a nature that it's disinteresting to him. And many, you know, I'm sure you've all, women have experienced where their husbands with the newborn don't really take, you know, real comfort level with the newborn. They don't want to change the diapers. They don't want to feed the kid. They don't want to get up in the middle of the night. That's the woman's job, right? I'm being facetious. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, I just came from 10 months of raising my newborn grandson. So, but does that, maybe that means I have a female soul. You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm.
All I can tell you is I've never had a homosexual experience. And if you, and the fact that I even need to express that shows you that it's part of my correction. But the answer to your question, I sense, my intuition tells me, that you can't have a loving God cannot ask someone to do a mitzvah that's going to put them at risk of their life. He may give them a nature to choose to do that, just as he's given the man the nature not to want it, but then given him the mitzvah, you need to do it. You want to connect to me, then you need to be with one woman and you need to bring children. Do you see how beautiful the system truly is?
Yeah.
On so many levels. And without understanding reincarnation, so much is lacking. Any other questions?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the questions. Tomorrow, there's a new basic class starting in the area where I am now, in Carson City, Nevada, and in Reno, Nevada. And there'll be a class at noon and another class at 6, because I'm trying to determine if there's enough students at the different times that might be interested. So if you're interested in starting the basic class over again from the beginning, or if you missed any of the basic class, or if you want to hear it in a different way, because every class is different, you're more than welcome to call into the class. It's the same call-in number and the same, you know, PIN number, but it will be at 12 o'clock tomorrow and at 6 p.m. tomorrow, West Coast time. Then Thursday at 10 p.m., we have a Zohar class. Saturday night with Motzi Yom Kippur, as I said last night, I'll still be eating or I'll be working on building a sukkah, because it's a mitzvah to start doing the actions of building the sukkah the night of Yom Kippur. And Sunday morning at 10:30, we're going to be talking and preparing ourselves for the holiday of Sukkot. which is really an amazing holiday. Any other questions? Have a beautiful week, a beautiful year. Please remember to do more spiritual work tomorrow and Thursday and Friday. Do more. Because whatever good deeds you do, even if it's just smiling as you walk down the street, you have no idea the good deed that a smile can bring. The more you do these days will impact all of your year. And one of the things that I'm sending an email out in a couple of days for people to realize, so you take it to heart. We're all busy preparing for Yom Kippur. We're all busy running and doing, and it's not like Pesach, but it's still very much involved. Look through your homes. Look through your businesses. There may be something borrowed that you've forgotten to return. Your teshuvah cannot be complete if you still are holding on to something material that was borrowed from someone, because that's part of your tikkun, it's part of your teshuvah. And if you forgot about that little thing, why did Jacob bring his families across the river Yabok? And then after they're all settled, he goes back across, swims back across, and that's where he meets and wrestles with the angel of Esav. Why did he go back? The Midrash says he went back for a minor silver kettle, a nothing piece of material. But it was to teach us the importance of not holding on to the material when it comes to this idea of something borrowed that we still hold on to. Yes, you intend to return it, but if you have it, it's theft. God forbid. Have a beautiful week.
Thank you.
Good
thank
night.
You.
Night. Thank you for your answers. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sure.